part two of my conversation with Alan and Ray, we talk about how the movement of playing Renaissance and Baroque music on authentic instruments got started in the United States, and their thoughts about ornamentation and other performance practices. My first question is, where did you guys first meet? How long ago was that? If I should even ask that.
Oh, boy. When you came down to Yale with the historical brass?
That's right, yeah. So that, I was in college, so maybe my senior year could have been 1972 or 73. We had a historical brass group in Boston. I guess we used six players. Obviously, I was playing cornetto with a guy named Dick Cook at the time, who was the leader of the group. And I don't really know the circumstances why how we got to Yale, but I remember we came down and you were there, and I think Bob was there. Nagel was there, too, I think.
My memory, of course, this is long before I ever taught there, so I was still in New York. I think he had some kind of a brass day. Bob Nagel arranged this at school, maybe. And so that there were some... I don't remember anything else, to tell you the truth, but Bob would have these occasional days. I remember he had, Army Brass Quintet up one time, and he had the guys from Eastman different times. So maybe it was an isolated instant. I don't remember. He didn't do it. He just played, right? As you remember, just played a I don't remember.
It really is a long time ago. I mean, we've been friends for a really long time. But
that's right.
I don't remember exactly the occasion, but I remember we had the group. And obviously that led to our association. I mean, we were associated in a lot of other things too, but I think the cornet playing was maybe the first thing. When only two of us in the Northeast, we ended up working together all the time. I needed nobody to take the work. So,
because I always thought that somehow you guys met in New York as freelancers.
Well, probably
that came later.
What year did you come down?
73.
Yeah. So yeah. Shortly after that. And my connection with Ray was again through the cornetto, basically. I don't even know exactly when the old cornet and sackbut ensemble started with Ben Peck in charge, but maybe around that time. I don't remember having any contact with you before the cornetto, do you?
No, I think you're right. I don't think we had any contact. And when I was in New York, even that fall of 73, I was getting around a little bit, and we knew each other. You got me on a couple of things. I remember a couple of church things, like
the high profile jobs.
the best jobs in town. You'd call me to be with you.
I remember you guys telling me that once you did a Baroque trumpet thing at a church, and you thought you actually played pretty well, and you came outside, and your girlfriends on the other side of the street wouldn't even come across to see you. Or something like that, because evidently it didn't go so well.
No, that was actually in Tully Hall.
Yeah. Oh, so it wasn't a church, it was Tully Hall.
It was probably the Clarion Society.
That's exactly what it was.
Newell Jenkins, a well-known orchestra at that point in the city. And he had this great idea. He always wanted to use cornets and sackbuts. And, of course, everybody else is playing modern instruments, which we learned very quickly on that you don't do that.
Yeah.
But anyway, that was it maybe Mozart? It was something fairly simple, wasn't it?
It was
classical.
It was too challenging,
sort of. And it was, of course, all modern pitch. And, we played our parts and really thought we'd done pretty well. But my wife at the time and Ray's girlfriend at the time were both in the audience that night. And so we finished the concert and we walk out the stage door. We're walking up towards Broadway on 6th Fifth Street. And we're laughing and talking and being very jolly. And we walk up and the two women are there and they're like mortified that we're like laughing and living it up. And they said, don't you realize that people in the audience were laughing? You guys were climbing notes, And that was the luxury of never to again play modern, with a modern orchestra on old instruments. It was bad news. I'm sure you may remember it differently. Right?
Well, no, I remember it very well because, if I'm not mistaken, that was the last time I ever played the Baroque trumpet in public.
Is that really?
I think it was, yeah. I think we had done a lot of things, and I really, I don't know, I didn't feel so good about that it seemed funny to people. I mean, I don't know, it didn't seem that funny to me.
I don't think I ever played it in a major hall again. I don't think so. And what cured me was I played a couple of Cantata 51s with the crowd at that point with Linda Kwan and Mark Shachtman and those people, you know, a couple churches. And I realized at that point, I don't really play this instrument very well, and I really can't play that piece. I would maybe get through the beginning, but when I got back to the Alleluia, sitting there holding it for a while and then trying to play, forget it, I miss every note. That, I think, pretty much got me hanging it on the wall about that time, too. And then some people came along who could really play. The whole level, just like on the cornetto, the whole level of playing changed completely. And even though we were pioneers, really, in the mid-60s, I started playing a cornetto in 66 or 7, sort of. And in the 70s, we were still the only two people playing the cornetto. And the fact that we could sort of play it and play it in tune and play a melody, everybody was astounded. They'd only heard it played horribly previous to that. So, we got away with murder for a number of years. Yeah. And then Bruce Dickey came along and ruined it all. Suddenly there were people who took the instrument really seriously, which neither one of us ever took.
Well, we were lucky, too, that we hooked up with the sackbut players that we hooked up with.
Exactly.
With Ben Peck, who was the leader of the group, and brought the music in and was very knowledgeable of the repertoire and the period. And just listening to him talk about the music we were playing, even in rehearsals, was fascinating. But we had six of us together. I remember those early days, Sunday night, we'd schlep up to 97th Street to Ben's apartment, and we'd sit around for a few hours just playing cornets and sack, but somewhat poorly at that time. And I even remember when Louise Basbus asked us to come and play at her church for a Sunday morning service. And we sort of debated it. It would have been a ton of fun playing the cornet and sackbuts that way, just rehearsing, playing music, fooling around. And then all of a sudden somebody wanted us to actually do it in public. And we sort of debated that a little bit. Do we really want to go this way? I mean, do we feel like we can really do this and feel okay about it? And one thing led to another. We did a lot of stuff. And until we played for Bruce Dickey, I think we thought we were doing
pretty well.
Did you actually play for Bruce Dickey?
We had one wonderful tour to Europe with the quintet.
Uh-huh.
In Germany and in Italy a bit. I don't remember how long the trip was, but we played some great I guess it came about because of that festival in Germany, right?
And I think that's right, yeah.
Mm-hmm. We played in Regensburg, which is a beautiful old medieval town on the Danube. And we played a concert there in this cathedral. I remember somebody from the newspaper coming up and saying, "How does it feel to be playing these instruments in a building that's from the period?" I said, "No, this building was built 500 years before we were playing the cornetto. It was built in like 1100.
Yeah, wow. Yeah, that's
true. We played a concert, then we toured up around in Germany, different places. And we played in Bologna, which is where Bruce had located and still is there. And we played in a church, and he already had made his mark, so we knew, whatever. So we played the concert, and we played like we always did. And afterwards, Bruce came up, and he was very complimentary, as Bruce would be, And then Ray and I walked out the door, and Ray looks at me and he says, Bruce hated absolutely everything we did."
Did you know beforehand that he was going to be there?
I think so, maybe. I'm not sure.
Maybe we had a suspicion that knowing he lived there, he might come around.
So you guys started the group just as a fun thing rather than, okay, let's start this group and we're going to play a bunch of concerts?
I want to say we did it for a year or two, just getting together when we could, maybe a couple of times a month. I remember, different person would bring the beer each time. So we'd have fun, and it was great fun. And we're playing music that was, relatively unfamiliar to all of us, maybe some Holborn or things that were more familiar. But it was a lot of fun. And it never occurred to us that, we're going to try to have a group and play concerts. Eventually got there, but that was certainly not on our radar when we started.
So how did you guys get into playing old music and old instruments in the first place?
Ray's got the best story. So
mine is pretty interesting. So I guess I was a sophomore at NEC, and Gunther Schuller was working on a commission for the Boston Symphony to celebrate the 150th anniversary of the Boston Museum of Fine Arts. And this piece that he was working on for the Boston Symphony was called Museum Piece, and it featured about a dozen Renaissance instruments as soloists out in the front of the group, in front of the orchestra. So, and clever, you know, kind of a cool idea that it would be, you know, somehow a historical thing, something. So this guy, Dick Cook, was a cornetto player. I don't know how he started playing, but he was in Boston and around New England Conservatory. And he just sort of casually, you know, would you be interested in trying to learn the cornetto to play this piece? So I was like, sure, you know, so I got a hold of one and I learned to play that piece. And literally, I really couldn't play anything on the cornetto except this piece. You know, it was like hard intervals and, you know, high note, this and that. I mean, I just woodshed saying, well, this is what I have to be able to do. So that's how I got into it. And it was after that that, and there were a couple of sagwa players, I think, in the ensemble as well. And it was after that that he suggested, well, you know, you're playing it now. We should actually try to play some of the real repertoire that you should play on it. And that's how I got started. And, you know, over time, we had that group in Boston. It was also a kind of a fun group. We played out, but I don't think it was all modern players that were not necessarily dedicated to, you know, becoming really skilled at the old instruments. I think it was much more a novelty for everyone in the group.
So tell me what other like Renaissance Baroque instruments do you play at? Alan, I know you play quite a few.
Well, the reason I started on the cornetto in the 60s was, as my students all know, I get a little bored with the trumpet and with its repertoire. And one day, this goes back to Ronnie Anderson. Ronnie, who was my colleague in the American Brass Quintet in 1964, 65. Ronnie played with the Pro Musica originally and played a little bit of cornetto and was one of the pioneers, and he'd long since abandoned it. But we got snowed in one Christmas and went to Ronnie's house to celebrate Christmas because we couldn't go back to Iowa, which was where I usually went back for Christmas. And we started drinking Brandy Alexanders, and Ron got out two recorders. Ron's wife, Fela, is from Germany, and he'd just been in Germany, and he picked up some recorders while he was there, a couple soprano, or not soprano and alto, maybe a tenor, I don't remember. And we sat down and started playing duets out of just two-part Bacchinia stuff from that period somehow. I remember it being a long time, a couple, 3 hours, we're drinking and playing the recording. I'd had music head masters. My brothers that played the saxophone and the clarinet, so I could finger up to a point. I got totally hooked. The next day I went down to 48th Street, Terminal Music, Artie Nitka, I don't remember any of these names. Artie was the recorder guy at Terminal Music, and I bought really good for the day, just commercially made, but a good soprano and alto wooden recorders, and started practicing to get away from the trumpet. And I love that music. You could play a whole slow movement of a Handel sonata and not get tired, you know, like we did on the trumpet. And suddenly I got really into Baroque music, which was having a real popular renaissance in the mid 60s, sort of, you know. So anyway, I showed up on a recorder job. Somebody knew I played a little bit. I think it was a Karl Orff Christmas piece that had 20 recorders, you know, so I could really hide. And I was in there. And Morris Newman, do you remember Morris Newman, Ray? Bassoon player?
Yeah.
So Morris was a colleague of mine in music at Turner, a couple different orchestras we played in. And he was a very good early music person, played good recorder and dulcian and stuff. And he said, what the hell are you doing playing recorder? And I said, well, I'd like to get away from the trumpet. He said, you got to learn the cornetto, because nobody in New York can play the cornetto. This was 1960, whatever. Five, maybe, 66, I don't remember. And I'd heard about these plastic cornettos that Christopher Monk made, and the New York Quintet, which I was in by that point, was going to Europe and spending some time in England. And I went down to Christopher Monk's house south of London and bought my first plastic cornetto. And I think that trip was 60, maybe 67. and cost $35. And he scraped my initials into the plastic Cornetto, I remember. It was leather covered, though, because I still have it. And he scraped the initials into the end, in the bell end. That's where they are, yeah. So I still have it. It's pretty beat now. And that got me started just on this instrument out of curiosity more than anything. And so I came back. I was still doing shows, I think, at that point, and various things. And I'd come home at night after work, and I'd play the cornetto. I was living in a musician's building up on West End Avenue, and I'd play the cornetto for a half hour, you know, and just kind of got into it. And then out of that came a group called Calliope, which, you know, we stayed together for 25 years. And it was all modern players who were interested in early music, basically. So that we got that group off the ground. Suddenly I could play recorder and I could play the cornetto. Then you can pick up the crumb horn, you can pick up a lot of things, you know, of the early Renaissance instruments. And that was our gimmick. We had four of us. We played like 40 different instruments. We didn't use a singer normally. And we had 25 years together.
Wow.
You know, not a full-time group by any means. We were always looked askance by the early music crowd because we were all modern players, you know. And we did a lot of crossover stuff. Peter Schickley wrote two pieces for us. We won the Naumburg in the mid-70s, and that came a commission. We got two totally useless pieces that people wrote for us that were all chromatic and all over the place.
Oh, yeah.
They sounded terrible. We played one of them in Tully Hall at the Naumburg concert. But Peter was the guy. We tried to commission Peter for the Naumburg, and they wouldn't accept him as a serious composer. And he knows these instruments. You know, he plays some recorder. He's always dealing with weird instruments, you know. So he wrote two really very successful pieces. Anyway, we were never quite accepted by the early music crowd, you know. And I'd say the cornets and sackbuts were a little bit in that same ballpark. Ben was the only true early music person in the ensemble, wouldn't you say?
Yeah.
So anyway, that's my history of the cornetto, which is, you know, I continued to play it at some level, never very well, but, you know, and I was taught at the American Recorder Society in the summer, and I'd teach a recorder class, and then I'd teach four people a cornetto or something, you know. And it kept me kind of active in that field. But like Ray, everything I learned about early music was strictly osmosis, just by the people I was playing with. Lucy Barda, who was in Calliope, knew that repertoire inside and out. I'd go to recorder workshops in the summer, and I'd photostat, photocopy scholarly editions of Izak and Juskin. Everybody brought these things from their schools, and then we all made copies of them. So upstairs, I have stacks and stacks of scholarly editions of all these composers. So that's, you know, that was a tremendous. I give it credit for keeping me interested in the trumpet. I always say that, but I think it's true that I would have burned out on the trumpet if I hadn't had that early music outlet.
I was going to ask if both of you, did you sort of learn ornamentation through osmosis, or did you read books, or just listen and talk to people?
Yeah, I learned from Alan. yes, through osmosis, there's no question that I was not a particularly good student at school. I mean, I got by, but I wasn't really, you know, interested in reading a lot or doing a lot of research things. So, yeah, I just would hear it and got used to doing it that way. And when I joined the American Brass Quintet, I came into the chair that Jerry Schwartz had in the group, and the group was, you know, doing a lot of a lot of Holborn and things that he had his own way sort of ornamenting things, very very fluid in a certain way. I mean, it's quite special. I don't think anybody else was playing like the way Jerry was playing in those days. So I was kind of trial by fire a little bit. I mean, I was coming into that chair and trying to sort of adapt my own playing to fit the way the group played. So yeah, listening to what he had done, you know, when I first joined the group, going to rehearsals, he was my first summer in Aspen when I joined the group, Jerry was still playing with the group, and I had that sort of 8 weeks, 9 weeks of sort of an adjustment period to get used to playing in the group. I rehearsed with them, but he still did the concerts. So that was actually a good thing. I mean, I was 21 and I was not, I had some experience, but I certainly was not, ready to kind of jump right in feet first. So I learned a lot from him. And as I said, sitting next to Alan and playing cornetto was another way. But I have books, you know, books right behind me on the library. But, you know, I have to say, I never got particularly enamored with reading them and sort of studying it. It was much more, you know, doing it by sound and hearing it.
Mm-hmm. The interesting story about Jerry is that Jerry's history goes back to Ron Anderson, who I just mentioned earlier. Jerry studied with when he was at music school and art, what do they call it? The School of Performing Arts, right, in New York City. Yeah. As a high school student, he studied with Ronnie. And he not only learned all of the contemporary literature of the ABQ, but he really got into early music and played a little bit of cornetto as well. But Ronnie was really into that scholarly approach to both new music and early music, and was very influential in the early days of the American Quintet in going in that direction, along with Arnold Fromm, the trombone player who founded the group. And Ronnie had, you know, an influence on me, certainly, but then I joined the New York Quintet, where the biggest ornament was at the end of a cadence, and that was it. You know? It wasn't forbidden, but nobody did it, so I didn't do anything with that group, really. But, you know, because of the recorder, I got into mostly the book by Ganassi, which is a big bunch of, he takes three notes, da da da, and gives you 18 ways to play a cadence on that. Mm-hmm. You know, and then da 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 da, and gives you 23 ways to play a cadence on that. That's kind of fun to look through and do, but you kind of learn some cliches just like a jazz book, you know, and then you throw them in. But after a while, Jerry liked to write out his ornaments, generally speaking.
Really?
Huh. At least that's in the early days. He tended to write them out because he didn't take any chances, you know, somehow. I just always played it by ear and often got caught. You know?
Yeah, but you know,
the rest of the group would get to one and I hadn't gotten there yet. You know?
I remember when we were playing together in the St. Louis Brass Quintet, and we were doing this, was it Sassato? No, Praetorius, I think, that you had arranged. And one movement was just a duet for two trumpets. And if it was towards the end of the tour and you were getting a little bit cranky and we'd had a long car ride or something like that, you would get so far out in the middle of it. I mean, it would be in major and you'd be ornamenting in minor or something like that. And I'd think in the middle of it, I'd be thinking to myself, he's not going to make it back. You know, you're not going to make it home. And you always did. I mean, it was amazing. And every night it was different, you know, so it was not thought out at all. But I think maybe that was your jazz experience.
Yeah, a lot. I think there's a real correlation there, you know. But I was never that great a jazz player, and I, you know, the artists in the early music crowd wouldn't necessarily have was a great ornamenter either. I'm sure, but I had a lot of fun doing it.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, Alan, you mentioned New York Pro Musica. I don't know why I went to this recently, but on YouTube there are some videos of the New York Pro Musica with Noah Greenberg conducting.
Wow.
And you know, it's interesting, and they're very, it's like very produced for the time. In other words, he says something about the pieces and introduces the instruments, and I know Arnie is in there, and I'm trying to remember, there's two cornettos, and I'm trying to remember if I knew who they were.
Well, it was Ronnie and Bob Montese.
That's who I didn't know. I think I recognized Ronnie, but I don't know who Bob
Bob
was.
Taught at Hunter College. Huh. And those were the two guys that, you know, owned Cornettos. They did some pretty wild playing, I'll tell you.
It's worth checking out, though.
I'd like to see that.
Yeah, go check it out on YouTube. I had no idea something like that would be there. But
That was a really unique group, the Old Pro Musica. I mean, it was a full-time job for a number of people. I mean, full-time. They were on salary year-round. And even when I first came to New York, that was still the case. When I came back after the Army in 63-4, I remember going to a concert with Sally Logerman at Tully Hall, and they were still on salary, a number of people. And then it all kind of fell through eventually. But Noah was the driving force for that, and I never got to know him. But they had parlayed, you know, they really pioneered early music on early instruments. There was nothing going on in Europe. It really started over here. Many ways it started with Hindemith at Yale, who had a collegium at Yale.
And Paul Hindemith?
Paul Hindemith did, yeah. And I can't tell you the dates, but I'd say late 50s, early 60s, whenever he was there. And he had a collegium and had some instruments and stuff. And people like Martha Bixler, two or three other real early music fanatics in the city that we knew, I can't come up with any other names, all studied with Hindemith at Yale. And they brought that kind of to New York along with Noah Greenberg. And like Martha was part of the original Pro Musica. And I can't tell you who else now, but
yeah, it's interesting. I don't know that there's a small early music ensemble in New York that's really full time, right? I mean,
no,
after Waverly, I guess Waverly, my started group.
Yeah, they were all the singers. Right? Singers were all part time. They were never full time either, really. Mm-hmm. Just for Mike and Kay, Mike Jaffe and his wife, who they were full time, and that they ran the group and probably paid themselves a salary. I don't know, but in any case, no, the singers and the other players were never full time. So yeah, that was really unique, you know, and it was true. It was the only group. I mean, there was nobody else doing that. And so it was unusual in pro music. I got to dig up that video. Is that on YouTube or something?
Yeah, I saw it on YouTube.
Yeah, all right, good. I'll check it out.
I always had the impression that somehow Europe was first with old music, and then it came over to New York.
But they were always very proud of the fact that they really started this through Hindemith and his subsequent people. Uh-huh. Really had started Renaissance music on early instruments. You know, it's really medieval and Renaissance, not nothing Baroque.
Wow.
And then it got picked up. And there's some great stories. I remember a great recorder player named Bernard Cranus, Bernie Cranus, who lived up here in the Berkshires, was in the old pro musica, but then really got into Baroque music and was a terrific recorder player. So he decided to organize a recorder workshop in New York, I think, and invited a number of recorder players from Europe to come. And they were, you know, the idea was to show them how it went, you know, that the American players were the real players. Everybody tells the story. These guys showed up from Europe and they all played circles around the people. They really started to take the recorder seriously. And in this country, I'd say Bernie Cranus was the only person who took the recorder, you know, kind of seriously as a professional in a way. It was everybody else did something else. And anyway, that's when the European tradition, particularly Baroque playing, really took off, and you know, the great Dutch tradition, you know, great recorder players. And, you know, same with the cornetto. I mean, you know, Bruce Dickey could never have made even approached a living in this country on the cornetto without teaching at a college somewhere. He'd have to teach the trumpet too, you know. But he moved over there originally to play the recorder, and then he's the first to admit, a terrible trumpet player who studied at Indiana University and said he was terrible. I don't know, terrible, but he said he wasn't really much of a trumpet player. But when he got to Europe, he went to study early music and study the recorder. And I'm talking out of school because I don't really know the story exactly, but somehow I always heard this weird story that he got his hand, he broke his wrist or somehow, and it was in a cast, and somehow he kind of knew about the recorder or about the cornetto, and he picked it up, and because his hand was tilted like you have to do on a cornetto, it fit his hand. I don't think that's probably true, but anyway, he really picked it up and single-handedly changed cornetto playing. I mean, really single-handedly. And then, you know, then he started teaching at the school in Basel and churned out, you know, many wonderful players. But that never took off here, really. You know, always one or two players in this country, you know, and a couple that surpassed us, but not, you know, not many players that really took it seriously here, because there was no money. You can't make any money on the cornetto, for crying out loud. You know?
I see it now with the young players at Juilliard. You know, we have a historical performance department, and many of the classical trumpet students want to take Baroque trumpet, and John Thiessen is there, and they can take lessons. We bought instruments. It's great to see. They're very interested in it, but I haven't had one of them want to play the cornetto.
Yeah,
they're shy with the cornetto, but the Baroque trumpet is much more something they adapt to or interested in.
It feels closer to home, even though it really isn't in a lot of ways. But still, there's money to be made on the Baroque trumpet. Not much, but a little bit, and potential for Baroque orchestra things around the country. Just, what are you going to do with the cornetto? I mean, you have to form a group. You have to have a group, and that's really hard to come by. The only people that even play at all now, pretty much in a college somewhere, where the trombone teacher had a sack butt hanging on the wall or something, you know, and they kind of get a little group going, something of that nature. But professionally, it's not a money-making instrument, let's face it. And Bruce, I mean, I don't think he's gotten rich, you know, but he's had a lot of teaching jobs. He's had the Concerto Palatino. He's had the group that's quite busy in some ways, you know, but he's carved out a career without playing the recorder and the crumhorn and the, you know, I mean, just playing the cornetto. And this turned out some great players, Jean Toubery, and some guys who really play. And it's wonderful to hear the cornetto played that way. And great admiration, because it's not in my chops, I'll tell you.
If you guys were playing, let's say, the same piece, a Holborn piece, let's say, or Susato or something like that, or a Baroque piece, Bach or Telemann, and you were playing it, if you were played it one day on the cornetto or a Baroque piece on the Baroque trumpet, and the next day on a modern trumpet or piccolo trumpet for Bach or whatever, would you ornament the same? Or since it's the same piece and the same style, would you ornament the same on the old instrument as compared to a modern instrument, or would you ornament differently? For example, like thinking of the Baroque trumpet, I mean, the Baroque trumpet has a limited register in the low register. And I hear a lot of people will do things on ornamentation with Baroque pieces that were not possible on the Baroque trumpet.
I mean, personally, I'd say you're playing, you know, we're playing a different enough instrument that you use the capabilities of the instrument. And if you happen to have some notes available to you to ornament a piece of music that you didn't have on the original instrument, I would draw the line and say you don't have to. I don't think the music police are going to show up and, like, you know, haul you off for that. And, you know, I guess if you were trying to play some type of authentic performance, well, first of all, you're not playing an authentic instrument, so that takes care of that right away. But I don't know. I would like to think that it's not quite as structured, or, you know, this was done this way and you don't want to cross any lines. I mean, I think there's some general thoughts about places that make sense to ornament, or obviously in Holborn or something, the cadences, you know, seems like they're designed to do that. But personally, I might not go a lot further than that in terms of sort of it can't be done or shouldn't be done because of some, you know, the limitations of a Baroque trumpet or something. I don't know. I see it that way.
Yeah, I'd agree. I mean, you know, you might not start a Bright Seraphim with a D major scale in bottom octave. <You know? laughs> But still, you can do so much more. And I think it gets exaggerated on the piccolo trumpet, where people just ornament something to death. It sounds ridiculous to me somehow.
Yeah.
But, you know, you've got the facility. You know, I don't see any reason not to do some things that you couldn't do on the Baroque trumpet. You know, it takes a Baroque trumpet player. You know, there's some guys who play it almost with the kind of facility of a piccolo trumpet, but still, it's limited, and I do hear ornaments that offend me a little bit, and I'm not easily offended. But that, you know, but still, you find a balance, and I think, you know, it used to be in my days in the American Quintet, which was about 4 years after it was started, 64, 65. You know, ornamenting was like, this is before Jerry now. But I mean, this was something that, you know, boy, we were into every hemiola and we were playing those ornaments, you know, and everybody was like getting into it. And I mean, we'd head for some cadences where, you know, three people were all, like a train wreck, you know. So we had to make some rules even in those days a little bit. Then when Jerry came along, Jerry made the rules, and he ornamented however he wanted to ornament, and did it spectacularly, of course.
Yeah, I would agree that the first time I heard the American Brass Quintet, I actually had not heard the group before I auditioned for the group. I mean, in those days, you know, there was no internet. I wasn't buying recordings the same way or anything, and so I actually got in the group, and they said, oh, well, we have a recital, you know, whenever the date was, you should come down, you should hear the group. And I remember being, you know, really sort of tickled by what Jerry could do. I mean, it was his own style. It was his own way of doing it, but it was very cool. And whether he broke rules or not, I found myself saying, man, for an audience, this is really a nice way to play old music. I mean, it puts a very different slant on it, but I bought in pretty quickly. I thought it was, I learned an awful lot from the guy, actually. I mean, I laugh about it. He was my first summer in Aspen. Then when I joined the quintet, he was still in Aspen. He's still playing with the quintet, but I was rehearsing with the group. He was my teacher that summer. I was actually a student that summer.
Oh, came out, okay.
On a fellowship, which is the way they could afford to pay two trumpet players to be there. Well, I came out as a fellowship student, and I learned in 8 lessons. I learned a lot from Jerry, I have to say. I mean, he sometimes was distracted, and sometimes he had things on his mind in a lesson. But when he was in the room, I have a lot of respect for the guy. He taught me a lot of things very quickly. I was very happy to have had that time with him.
Yeah, I mean, he had an articulation that's you know, I mean, you like it or you hate it, in a way, as a trumpet player. I mean, Jerry was a controversial, very controversial player as a young kid, because he really climbed the ladder very fast and bumped a few people off the ladder along the way, but justifiably in many ways. But he always had the first recording that he did of all the Frescobaldi and Fontana sonatas, with just harpsichord and bassoon, you know. I mean, that's an articulation that, you know, has nothing to do with the trumpet, in a way. I mean, it's incredibly musical. It's like this kind of soft tongue that's closer to the cornetto than the trumpet in many ways. And the typical B-flat trumpet player was not into it particularly. You know, it wasn't tick-a-tick-a-tick, it was it was that kind of thing that was spectacular, I think, and worked incredibly well on those pieces that he chose to play, which is the first recording he ever did, really. I remember we talked about it. He said, do you think I should be doing something? I should be recording the Haydn and the Hummel, but I want to do this early music and go for it. You know? So, was maybe for none such. I don't remember Delos. I've forgotten the earliest thing that he did, but it was unusual in that, you know, Chris Gecker to this day talks about his, you know, that articulation of
I think that was the first record that he did. I remember it as a student having that record.
Yeah, sure.
Actually, I showed it to Tom Stevens. It had a picture of Jerry, I think maybe on the back, and he had, you know, fairly short hair. And this was like late 60s, I guess. And Tom's reply, just looking at the picture, was something like, we couldn't count on him in a revolution at all.
Please join Alan and Ray in the bonus room, where they talk about their teaching careers and the differences between teaching at Yale University and the Juilliard School of Music.